So now the you can ask questions or anything you'd like me to elaborate on, whatever. Yes? Well, it's like suffering is like the first noble truth. It's the beauty of life. If we understand the how to let go of suffering, then we can experience the beauty of it. You see, so even though we do experience the beauty of it in moments, but we can also just like. You know, we can be totally lost in our own sense of despair or that even in the most beautiful and salubrious situations, just because of, you know, being attached to some idea, some emotional habit that we have. So that's why raising the suffering up to a sense of a noble truth is to investigate it, to see this sense of blind attachment to wanting things or not wanting things. And once we see through that, then we experience like a lot of joy from just conscious being, because there is, you know, that basically we're experiencing, you know, this realm with its, with all its suffering and problems, is really supported by love, unconditioned love. So we're, you know, by letting go of our own kind of delusions about ourselves and defining ourselves through what's unreal, we let go of that. And then we experience this, what is like unconditioned love, or this sense of joyfulness. In regards to the goodness, like I have, you know, I found out, it became apparent that, you know, in my own character, my own personal way of looking at life was based on jealousy. And because of being brought up in a competitive system where you're always looking, you know, at the one that's better than you are. And so you feel envious or jealous, and this seems to be encouraged in the culture, you know, even though because of this sense of your self-worth, prove yourself, you have to prove yourself somehow better than somebody else. And this was, and so even though I didn't like this emotion, didn't want this feeling, yet this was so much a way what I would experience was when people were better or more gifted or more appreciated or whatever, then I'd feel this jealousy, which I didn't like. And then I see this in the what they call the Brahma Viharas, the four Brahma Viharas, the Metta, Karuna, Mudita, Upeka. These are, they're called the four heavenly abodes, and these heavenly abodes come from the pure consciousness. You know, they're not created states, and they're not, you can't create them out of willfulness. But they are available to us when we let go of self-centeredness and ambition and self-consciousness. And so I began to, and I find now, a sense of mudita, or sympathetic joy, as a kind of response to life. And this is a very joyful kind of reality of being that is through reflecting on the beauty of life and the goodness of others. So it's interesting at a time where there's so much depressing information on the media, you know, so you you listen to the news on the radio and you hear, you know, people being bombed and brutalized in Africa and in the Middle East and on like this, and you just feel this sense of just endless kind of violence. And then the things that happen within this country, a little boy gets killed, you know, shot in the head, or, you know, nobody quite figures out why. And these are images that you hear in the media now, very strong, violent images. And then they're reflecting on those kind of images, it's conscious, held in consciousness, you feel a sense of despair it's an unpleasant negative feeling about the state of humanity. So one of the mudita reflections was, I sympathetically rejoice in the inconceivably vast oceans of good actions performed by conscious beings since beginningless time. I think that is absolutely beautiful. I mean, it sounds a bit of a mouthful, I admit, but it is from Mahayana. And they're prone towards hyperbolic ways of saying things. But what this means, you know, you're thinking basically of the goodness of humanity and of other beings, you know, whether it's animal kingdom or whatever, that there is so many good actions through beings from beginningless time, inconceivably vast oceans. And so then, you know, you're not refusing to the information about the meanness and of terrorism and the hatred and bullying and the nasty part of humanity, but also we need to bring into a consciousness this goodness, because it's real. You know, when you look at yourself, you know, I could exaggerate on a personal level my, you know, if my feeling of anger or my selfish emotion that might arise in a given situation. But basically, when I began to appreciate delight in my own goodness, it wasn't from a sense of conceit, and, you know, aren't I a wonderful person? It's just recognizing, basically, you know, that I love the good, the true, the beautiful. This is what I prefer. This is what I want to be with. This is what I incline to. I don't want to go and become a criminal or a drug addict I wouldn't want to be, you know, move in, join the mafia or the Ku Klux Klan or anything like that. Never felt attracted to those kind of violent organizations that preach hatred. Because I can see, you know, basically I have a karmic character that loves the good. And that doesn't mean that I'm good as a kind of permanent state, but it does give me a sense of worth that is not cheating or lying about it or exaggerating. Then in mindfulness meditation, you're contacting that. You're beginning to recognize this, your true nature is this unconditioned love. When you get to the bottom, where there's no attachment whatsoever, you're completely free from attaching to conditioned phenomena, this is unconditioned love. Deathless. It's the deathless. It's real. And by unconditioned love, it's not sentimental. You know, it's accepting. It's allowing. It's receptive. And it doesn't criticize or judge. Now, as the effect of the meditation, you know, of the mindfulness practice, then this becomes, you know, you're in touch with reality. You're recognizing what's real rather than seeing unconditioned love as some kind of faraway ideal. You know, so it can be just an ideal that is beautiful, and desirable, but may seem so remote from your own experience, because maybe we experience life through self-criticism, self-aversion, self-disparagement, or feeling, you know, dwelling on what's wrong with the people we live with, or the society we're in, or the world that we're experiencing. So when you hear the news, it's all so depressing. That's how many people get slaughtered in Baghdad and other places, and it just goes on and on and on, you know, the kind of miserable perceptions that one acquires, and this is the state of the world, so you think it's all, you know, so everything's falling apart. So when talking about reality, then this unconditioned love is real. I'm not creating it. It's not kind of ignoring everything to live in a kind of airy-fairy world of bliss, because unconditioned love receives everything. So it receives the bad, the good, the right, the wrong. It has no preferences. And so this is, you know, this you can realize for yourself. This is what we call realization. It's not where an ideal of unconditioned love can be very idealistic and inspiring, but you may not work in daily life, because because daily life isn't ideal. You know, you have to live in a society where, you know, a lot of what you experience is unpleasant. Greed and selfishness and rudeness and jealousy and fear and that. Very, you know, part of most societies. Family life and social relationships. I know this is, you know, contemplating what's real. And because this is, like with me, the third noble truth in the, you know, the essential teaching of the Buddha, the four noble truths. The third noble truth is a very profound insight into reality. So, I mean, you know, it's a subtle realization. To use the word profound makes it sound too extreme. But you through this awareness practice, then you begin to recognize the suffering you create through attaching, through trying to control, attach, and cling to things, and try to resist and get rid of things you don't like or don't want, and then through seeing the suffering you create through that, you let go. In other words, you relax, you release your grip on this desire to control and make things what you want. And then you realize the cessation of these desires. Now, when desire ceases, your consciousness is still operating. And you discern this sense of consciousness without clinging to desire is all-embracing. You know, and it's not a personal. It's not like, you know, I can't claim it as something, a personal attainment or achievement in any way. It's natural and it's real. But it can be completely ignored in our lives through the conditioning process that we acquire, you know, after birth. We become conditioned, programmed into our, our culture, ethnic group or class or social position, whatever. We become conditioned to identify and programmed to believe in the very values of right and wrong, good and bad, according to the particular cultures. Now, in an awakened awareness, then we can see through, you know, it's just to see through that we're not limited and bound into the cultural conditioning or the intellectual conditioning that we have, or the emotional conditioning. We can, that which we can be aware of emotion, like being aware of sadness around the death of Alan Cole, is not indulging in negative mental states. Because that perception of Alan Cole died committing suicide, that's sad. That's not a happy perception, at least in my experience. You know, it doesn't make me happy to think that. And so what it does is if you're using it, trying to describe the feeling, is sad, a sadness from, you know, having that perception. And that which is aware of the sadness is not sad. So then you see, my refuge is in the awareness, not in the emotion anymore. But it's not a rejection of the emotion. I'm not trying to be happy and indifferent about Alan's death. Nor am I going to indulge in sadness and you know, just hold to that as some kind of, you know, that I have to feel this in order to, you know, accept this fact. But it's through my reference, my reflection back to the awareness that I can bear with sadness, with grief, with loss, with praise and blame. Because this is what all human life is about, isn't it? It's everybody's life. You know, it's about loss, when you think of it. So, you know, we have to lose everything at the end. Death is, the total, you know, giving up the body. And so, you know, that everything ends in old age, sickness, death. Now, that can be depressing, if you attach to the idea of it. But yet, it's the way it is. You know, this body is not getting more vigorous and younger. You know, it gets older and older every year, and stiffer. Now that could be, you know, taken from a personal level, you know, personal conditioning. Nobody wants to get old and stiff, get wrinkled, and have to be shoved off in some horrible nursing home that stinks of urine. With people that don't care about you and just trying to do their job for a wage, you know, nobody wants that. But if that happens, then, you know, then knowing this, one can bear with whatever happens. You know, because you're not, you know, it doesn't mean that you'll like it or seek it, but if that's the way it goes, then that's my refuge is in the awareness, not in trying to make my life comfortable and pleasant till I die. So this gives me a sense of, like, not dreading getting old. You know, like, it gives me a sense of being able to take whatever comes, whatever I get out of the rest of my life. You know, not to worry about it, not to create into anything, you know, that could be quite, you know, distressing for someone my age. You know, who's going to need me? Who's going to feed me? And that was 64. But it is, because Buddhism oftentimes is criticized by other religions, fact that it seems to stress suffering so much, especially Theravada, the Four Noble Truths, and this suffering becomes a kind of, it's the essential teaching. And you know, where most other religions are, you know, coming from more metaphysical positioning, where, you know, it's, you know, love as the ultimate, where you take all his love and happiness and fulfillment and wholeness and oneness. Now this is inspiring. And just in terms of, if one wants to inspire your conscious experience here, now you talk about love and eternal life and eternal happiness. And you use positive terms and superlatives, and you can create a very inspired state of mind. And then you can create a very hellish one. You know, if you've told a lie, you're going to be punished. You're going to have to go to a hell realm where the demons are going to pull your tongue out with red hot tongs for 84,000 eons. And that's your punishment. Because you told a lie. But it was only a little white lie. Well, maybe 83,000 eons. And Pat Robertson, you know, this American politician, you know, he goes, God talks to Pat Robertson and tells him, you know, the Americans should invade Iraq and all this kind of thing. So these are the kind of, you know, this is, if God starts talking to you, don't believe it. You know? So this is my advice, especially if it's about, you know, doing somebody in or invading Iraq. If God starts saying, well, go out in love without the help of anything on earth, that's probably a good thing to do. You know, but if it's, those are the enemies, those evil forces over there, those Islamic terrorists and those evil Al-Qaeda and that Osama bin Laden and those Iranians, you know, they're really trying to get us, you know, wound up about Iran. About how evil Iran is, and it's, you know, it's playing on this emotional ignorance that we suffer from, in a supposedly intelligent world, civilized world. But it's not true, you know. It's not evil over there, and we're for God and is on our side. This is human delusion, definitely. But, you know, if one starts having such thoughts, you know, if those kind of voices start arising in one, and at least you can be aware of it as conditioned phenomena. Now that's reality, isn't it? Because whatever it is, if God says, go and kill all the Islamic terrorists, you know, what I can know in the moment is that is a condition arising and ceasing. Now this is a way of you know, finding, you know, within yourself that which knows, which is in touch with universal wisdom rather than just political biases or cultural or religious prejudices. So you begin to see that if God says, go out and kill the Taliban, you know, something, you know, Buddhist monk wouldn't do. So you can't do that, God. It's against the Vinaya. But, and I might even, you know, if the Taliban has had some, you know, direct effect on me, like if the Taliban invaded Amaravati and killed all the monks and nuns, you know, then it's getting pretty close, isn't it? And I might feel like I want to kill all the Taliban. Now, this is an absurd example, but But, you know, I can be aware of that, you know, of the, because to me, the Taliban, I've never met one, and so it doesn't, you know, and it doesn't affect anything in my life in the present that I'm aware of. And, you know, where what the President of the United States does affect me more strongly than the Taliban at this moment. So, and this, being aware of this, how this feeling, emotion arises around this, you know, and being aware that what arises ceases. Now, this is very direct recognition of the way it is. What arises ceases. What begins ends. And then that which is aware of the rising and ceasing, beginning and ending, is not arising and ceasing, beginning and ending. So then you're getting in touch. You know, you've recognized ultimate reality. It's real. This stillness, this inner stillness, is reality. It's real, and it isn't created by me, or it isn't dependent on conditions being any what way or which way, whatever. It's like this. So then. Then you, from this point, then you have perspective on what he, so even if, you know, says you should kill yourself or kill somebody else or do something for the sake, because the Buddha wants you to do it. You know, I could, if I, on a personal level, think I'm going crazy, because that to me is crazy. You know, if the Buddha, if I should have some delusion, the Buddha says, go and kill off, the Pat Robertson. And then I could say to Pat Robertson, I'm sorry about this, but Buddha told me to do that is absurd, isn't it? But one thing I know, and then I'm not suffering from such delusions, but they yet anyway, but it is recognizing that it is, you know, a feeling or a thought, and it is arising, ceasing. So that's real. The arising cessation of it is real. The quality, you know, could be fantasy, delusion, could be. It's sensible, reasonable, logical, inspiring, depressing, whatever. Because those are qualities of conditions that are dependent on other qualities. So like in Vipassana meditation, it's looking into the nature of things, the way it is. You know, it's the word investigating is very important in the Buddhist concepts, because we're encouraged, you know, the whole point of the teaching is to investigate, to use our conscious experience for investigating rather than for holding on to beliefs. Like we can, our own cultural conditioning, we can believe in what we're told, and operate from beliefs because of the conditioning process. Some of our beliefs can be very good ones. You know, beliefs can be anything. They can be right, wrong, good, bad, sane, insane. So, because they're conditions. Beliefs are not real. They're conditions. And so you're looking at the nature of conditions rather than being dazzled or averse to the quality of the condition. Where on a personal level, I would, you know, I have strong emotional reactions to certain things, you know, certain other conditions. So, I remember, I know this monk, and he's very placid. He's not here at this monastery, some other place. Very placid, and every time I go see him, he's always seems so completely cool and polite and proper and everything's under control. And he was admirable. I've known him for years. Lovely monk. So I went to see him recently, and I took a book written by somebody in the other sect in Thailand. And so you present the tray, you know, candles, incense, and flowers. And I put this book on the tray and presented it to him, and he receives it very nicely, and then he looks at the book and he loses it. First time in 30 years I've seen him blow it. I found his weakness. But also, you know, look at that in yourself, how you, you know, like where I lose it, where, you know, the things that I'm interested in, what really, you know, threatens me on an emotional level, or what, you know, which I find confusing or exasperating, or these kind of emotions. It's you know, because it's like going to where, you know, it's a sign where you need, you know, you can investigate. Why do I feel so threatened or averse when this subject is mentioned, or when this somebody acts like this? Why do I feel like this? You know, so it's a point of looking at myself rather than wishing, well, why does that person have to act like that? They're, you know, this is a nice, peaceful community, and then he does that, and it upsets everybody, and it's not. And you'll blame it on somebody else. I'm quite capable of doing that on a personal level. but I don't believe it. Because, you know, I find, you know, that now, where you're looking at life as it's happening, rather than wanting it to stay a certain way, trying to hold it and control it into a nice, harmonious monastic community where you personally feel everything is fine, even though I quite like that feeling still. But it's like, you know, that life is not, you can't sustain that. That things do come in. You know, there is the snake in the garden, the worm in the apple, the fly in the ointment. There's always something as you get the beautiful sunny day, and then, you know, and then a cloud comes. Why? You know, why can't you just keep it the way that on the ideal level? And then this is the Buddha. It's not like that. That's not reality. Reality is not ideal. It's like this. It's changing. And so that's why the Buddha used this dukkha or suffering as a noble truth, because this is what we're always struggling to resist. You know, we want happiness. The big desire of all of us, you know, human beings, is for security and happiness. Let's face it, you know, we want stable government, human rights, high standard of living, and trustworthy friends, and good, faithful relationships, partners, and on like this. We want all the best and that we can think of on the ideal level. And then we feel disappointed because life isn't going to present us with an ongoing diet of the best. And so that, you know, this sense of learning from the way it is just, you know, it's like in Buddhist countries, they talk a lot about the law of karma, which is not very well understood in the West, but it's, you know, like the karma I see everything that happens is karma, is, you know, it's putting it with a personal pronoun, my karma is like this. So it's not a passive kind of resignation to misery and failure or that, but it is, it's this acceptance of karma that we can learn from it. and understand it, because so that whatever happens to you, then seeing it as something to learn from, rather than as something that's destroying your life or ruining your life, or you know, is unfair and somebody else's fault, even if it is somebody else's fault. Because a lot of life isn't fair, and a lot of misery comes from other people's insensitivity and selfishness, you know, that we have to, you know, we're the objects of. It's not, you know, but also, we can't control that. I can't make people be what I want, or be good and dependable, honest and supportive and trustworthy. you know, I can encourage, but I can't make anybody do it. It's beyond, you know. So then this is where then accepting people the way they are is a challenge for someone in my position. Because this is what I've learned after all these years in a monastery, is accepting the way it is, which is not passive resignation to negative conditions, but a way of accepting the reality of now and able to respond to it in a skillful way. So sometimes the response is passive, and sometimes it's active. It's more intuitive rather than prescriptive. So I can't say you should always, you know, resist evil and get if anybody comes in here with evil intentions, just kick them out of the monastery. And you know, and I can certainly feel that desire to do so, but that isn't always the best response in a situation. And this is where it's more intuitive, you know, where you're trusting on that level of intuition rather than on, you know, get rid of what you don't like as quickly as possible. It's interesting, in Thailand, you live in the jungles there, and before coming to England, you know, I lived in this little bamboo hut in the forest, one day I went back to my hut in the evening after the puja, evening puja, and it was, and my hut had been taken over by termites. So the whole hut was covered in termites, literally upholstered in termites. And there is not a place I could step without stepping on termites. And termites are very soft. They have soft, succulent bodies. And so, you know, just trying to sweep them away, you'd kill them. And so one of our training rules is not to kill anything with intention. So I felt this incredible anger and frustration, rage almost. You know, I just wanted to get rid of the termites, because they'd taken over my hut. And I felt, you know, they were going to eat it. I had this idea that termites would eat the whole hut, and by the morning there'd be nothing left. So, anyway, there's nothing I could do, so I went and slept somewhere else. And in the morning I went back. The hut was there. Termites were gone. You know, they were just passing through. You know, I found out through the termite grapevine that they'd come to pay respects. And I totally misunderstood. Gave them, it took the worst possible scenario that they'd come there to destroy and eat my bamboo hut and make my life inconvenient. And so this is, you know, how, you know, then termites, what they do, they seem to go on migrations. And my hut seem to be in the path that they move in. And they don't, you know, they don't go around, they just go through. So they're just passing through, you know. And they were gone the next morning, not one in sight. And that was quite a good reflection on the amount of incredible anger and rage I felt towards them the night before over this. You know, nothing terribly important. Bamboo hut is, you know, plenty of bamboo in Thailand. Nothing, you know, they weren't, you know, even if they did eat it, it wouldn't be that great a loss. You know, build another one. But there's this feeling of being threatened, my hut, my place, and they have no right to be there, and wanting to get rid of them, wanting to, you know, kill them all, get rid of them, sweep them away, spray them with insecticide. But because of the monastic precept, you can't do that, you see. So there was the rage and the desire and the energy, but because of the precept, they had to consider the precept. I couldn't intentionally do that. So because I put the precept first, you know, I decided that was the important one. So then the next morning, you know, I felt this sense of relief and learned from it, how enraged I can get over somebody invading my space. Put that in the modern terminologies. You're invading my space, that kind of thing. Is how we think here in England, isn't it? And how dare you invade my space? The learning from these, you know, where, you know, I encourage this because you really, it makes your life, you really learn from life when you can look at where you fail all the time, where you get blown away, you overreact, you lose it, you know, rather than just hating yourself or endlessly feeling guilty or self-critical about it, just take it as a something to take an interest in. Why do I get so angry or upset over that, you know, and not to see it in analytical terms, in terms of there's something in your past, but in terms of you know, that this is a condition, you know, a sense of self, my hut, my place, how dare they, this is happening to me, I don't want this. And so therefore, you know, you can see the clinging and the idea, sense of me and mine arising around just this, you know, this is a long time ago, before I ever came here. But it is, I remember it vividly because of the of using a situation for reflection. Any more questions? Yes? Yeah, well, that's a good question, because that is just to be aware of it, and there is a desire, you know, like you can easily, you understand the theory, but then also there's a desire to get rid of it. If I'm aware of it, it'll go away. There's a kind of, you know, being aware will make it go away. There's still a desire to get rid of it. That's what you're clinging to. So then I'd use, oh, well, stay forever. when you say something, sometimes they go away very quickly. So next week I will, it'll be Ajahn Majiro, since I'll be giving retreat. Here in the retreat center. And so I will, the next two Sundays, I will not be giving the talk. So. Just warning you. Can close now?